let me in. Shibba, shibba. I want to be closer to you. Shibba, shibba. Open up your soul. Shibba, shibba. Let me find that part of you, the part that nobody ever knew.
Let me touch your.
Hello and welcome to Let Me Touch Your Mind, the show where we try to get you to be something, do something, experience something, enjoy something. It's the first Monday of the month, and you know what that means. We've got a science envoy from the Wonderfest organization to talk about science in a way that makes you understand it and go, oh, that wasn't terrible at all. That was actually really interesting. Here to talk about science in an engaging way, I'd like to welcome Ashley Moses. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on the show. Before we get into the science, like what you do science-wise, when did you first get bitten by the science bug?
Oh, I remember this pretty vividly, actually. It was in the first grade with my mom. We did a science fair project where we watched water move through celery stalks. It's actually a process called translocation, but I had no idea. I thought it was pure magic. And I'm watching these celery stalks light up with all these beautiful colors. It's got blue and red and orange, and I was just hooked. I was like, science is the process by which I can understand the world around me, even if it's something as simple as a celery stalk that I might keep in my fridge. This is really, really cool. And from there, I've just not stopped doing science.
Okay. I've got a lot of questions about this celery experiment. Okay. So you're six years old. There's a science fair, which I didn't even know they had for six-year-olds, which I think is pretty great. How do you see water moving through celery, and how do you see all these colors?
Yeah, so you, and I will try my best to remember all the details from first grade. So
okay.
If it's a little murky, please forgive me.
That's all right.
Essentially, you put celery stalks inside cups with dyed water, right?
Oh, so
you just put some food coloring into a glass of water, and over time, maybe the course of days, I think it might have been days or weeks, you would just watch the water be at one level in the celery stalk, and then the next, and then the next level, and eventually the stalk is orange, or the whole stalk is blue. And it's pretty crazy.
That's amazing. And were you did you have any expectations when you started the science experiment, or was it, like you said, just pure magic? You had no idea.
Oh gosh, I don't remember having any expectations. If I'm in first grade, I'll be honest with you, my mom probably picked the experiment.
Oh, okay.
I don't think I knew much about translocation or that you could just stick celery in water. I'm sure as time went on, I realized how cool it was and what I might expect down the line.
Mm-hmm.
But for a first grader, that was just, it was pure magic, no expectations. I think that's pretty beautiful. Seeing science through the lens of a kid, or remembering it when you were a kid, it is magic.
So you said, so you had this magical awakening about how cool science was. So did your elementary and junior high and high school science experience keep bearing that out, or was it by dint of just sheer perseverance that you continued to like science?
I think the magic has still stayed at least a little bit, especially when you consider some of the techniques that we have in the world of science as a whole. So my field is neuroscience, and so that's what I'm most aware of. But the techniques all over the field, in my mind, are just magic. There's a technique I used to use a couple years ago before I became a graduate student, where I could turn a brain from a brain that looks like a bunch of tissue and it kind of has this pink color to a brain that literally looks like glass that I could then observe under a microscope. And I kid you not.
How do you do that?
In my 20s or my late 20s, and I still believe that it's magic and it's beautiful.
How do you do that? How do you do it? How do you turn your brain into glass?
It actually takes an entire month So I guess just imagine a scientist in a laboratory putting a bunch of different chemical solutions on these brains and washing them in these different sorts of liquids. And then eventually, 30 days later, the brain has become clear, literally just
really.
And then you can put it under a microscope and you can view this beautiful constellation of cells that exists within the brain. And for those who are interested, it's actually a process called iDisco, which is a fun name, I think.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's called brain clearing. You are literally clearing the brain of its tissue component.
Wow.
It is magical.
So then is it kind of like clear jello, or what's the consistency of it? Is it still a brain?
It's harder, actually. I'm trying to think of an analogy, but those stringy lights you hang on a Christmas tree?
Yeah.
And some of them are different colors, but sometimes you get those clear ones.
Yeah.
That's the clear color, it looks like, and it's actually pretty hard as well. And so you've gotten rid of the squishiness of the brain, and it allows you to then, like I said, image it under a microscope. So imagine a white Christmas light.
Wow. And it amazes me. I mean, it shouldn't, but it amazes me that some scientist at some point figured that out. This is like, I'm turning the brain into basically a quartz crystal so that I can look at it easier. That's crazy. What other magic can you tell me about? That, like, things that you thought were magic that you can do as a scientist?
Oh, wow. Another one would be this technique called optogenetics.
Uh-huh.
Essentially, it is using genetics to allow you to use light to control the brain. You can put these really, really cool things inside. I work in mice, and so most of this work is done in mice. And so you could put these really, really cool genetic substances into the brain of a mouse. And then with light, you can control certain aspects of the mouse's brain. And so that's actually some of the stuff that I do in my PhD currently, which is where if you're trying to maybe target a certain population of brain cells, you can use genetics to do that. And then you can stimulate them with light. And I think that is just fantastical. I can't even believe that exists, but it's been happening for a bit. And these techniques are just getting even cooler.
So when you say for a bit, are we talking a year, 10 years? What are we talking about? What are we looking at?
I believe optogenetics has been around since 2005.
Okay.
That would be 20 years.
Yeah.
But for me, as a scientist in my career, I really only learned about it maybe 5 or 10 years ago. And then I've only been able to actually do it maybe 1 or 2 years ago. So it kind of feels like it's happening all over for me, even though it's been 20 years.
Well, I'm only hearing about it today, so wow. Because it seems like science will sort of go along and then make these enormous leaps and then just sort of go along for a number of years. And then there's suddenly almost like, the Industrial Revolution, like, boom, now we're doing this, and everyone's doing it. And you're like, what's going on here?
Absolutely, absolutely. It's pretty cool. And once a technique is developed, it might take those 20 years for people to discover some really, really cool things to kind of, I don't want to say exhaust the technique, but really live it out to its full potential. And then it's time maybe for a new one, and there's a whole new set of decades or years spent, again, using that technique to its full potential. So it's pretty darn cool.
Very cool. Very cool. Okay, so we're going to go backwards a little bit in time. So we've moved forward through your, the formative years, and you get into college. And what was your path to neuroscience? Did you start with a different type of science and transition in, or was it like, boom, neuroscience, that's it for me?
a little bit of both, maybe. There's a little bit of a boom neuroscientist for me, but also the different steps led me to the specificities of the neuroscience that I'm in now. So when I was in high school, I knew that I was really excited about the brain and behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to know why we acted the way that we did, whether it was positively or negatively, just very broadly. Why are we doing what we're doing,
mm-hmm.
what's going on under the hood. And I heard from a friend at the time of this field called neuroscience. And I was like, wait a sec, that is exactly what I'm looking for. This is the brain and this is behavior. This is super cool.
Okay.
So I went to college and I was really interested in doing some form of neuroscience, mm-hmm. probably some form of neuroscience research, because I thought being a professor sounded really cool. Teaching and discovering the world all at the same time sounded just like that magic I'd been following
mm-hmm.
since
mm-hmm.
first grade. And then I got into college and got into a program that allowed you to get into research right off the bat.
Okay.
So I started experimenting with psychology research and human research and mouse research and behavioral neuroscience and all this sort of stuff, which has led me to where I am today, which is what I would call behavioral neuroscience research in mice.
Okay. You mentioned earlier that you could use DNA to control mice. And when you talk about control, what is it that you're controlling? Physical movements, emotional movements, how they eat? What does that mean?
You can do almost anything. For me, I'm trying to discover what that behavioral output might be. So I'm trying to shine the light in the mouse's brain and just see what happens.
Uh-huh.
But I know some folks who can shine light in the mouse's brain and alter their mating behavior.
Really?
There are people who can do the same thing and alter their feeding behavior. If you direct this light towards the appropriate brain cells and the appropriate brain region, the appropriate
uh-huh.
brain circuit,
uh-huh.
you can, in some instances, elicit these really, really interesting behavioral results. On my end, like I've mentioned, it's a little bit more exploratory because I'm at the beginning of my PhD project. I'm trying to figure out what's happening in this circuit I'm interested in.
Okay.
But for others, it's a little bit more obvious and quite grand, really.
Okay, so I have like a million questions, and some of them relate to gaming and social media. So
cool.
So you have the ability. Let's start with what is it you're introducing to elicit these changes in behaviors? Is it a food? Is it a shot? What is it?
You mean, what am I introducing in the mouth?
Yeah.
You really are just shining light into the brain.
But
and with light, sorry, go ahead.
No. Because so that means that their brain, their little mouse skulls are open and you're just.
Oh, yes. I should have made that quite specific. I apologize.
That's all right.
So we do these really technical mouse brain surgeries. And I'd like to preface by saying the mouse survives beautifully.
Okay.
They run around, they eat, they're happy, all the things. So it's kind of like having maybe like your wisdom teeth taken out. You have a specific surgery, you recover, and then you're sort of back to normal.
Uh-huh.
The same thing with these mice. So what we do is we put a fiber, a really cool opto fiber into the mouse's brain that allows us to administer light.
Okay.
And this light is what then activates the cells in the brain in this specific brain region or specific circuit or whatever it may be.
Uh-huh.
And then we can observe their behavior. But it's all through this fiber in the brain, which is attached
wow.
to a cord, and it allows you to just put light in there.
Do people compare it to the show Severance, that you're putting this, introducing this little thing into brains to change behavior?
You know, I have never heard of optogenetics compared to Severance, but I'm sure you could draw some parallels.
So you introduce this tiny fiber, and then this fiber, I don't understand how it works. How does it trigger? Explain
sure.
that, please.
So what we do is and I'm happy to provide as much information as possible. Let me know if at any point this is making it more confusing.
Oh, no.
Essentially, what we do is we put these special light-sensitive molecules into the mouse's brain.
Oh, they're molecular.
That then exist
okay.
in the brain.
Okay.
It's kind of like maybe injecting a drug in the mouse's brain, right? You inject it in a certain region, and then it exists
okay.
in those cells in that region.
Okay.
And those light-sensitive molecules are then able to be either activated or inhibited when I shine light into the mouse's brain. So I shine light through the fiber, and that allows me to either, again, activate or inhibit those neurons.
But if
those cells.
But if they've had this surgery, you've put this fiber in, you've sewn their little skulls, you know, their little heads back up. So how does the light get to the fiber if it's inside their skulls?
All right. It's all connected through a fiber. So it's kind of like when I plug my headphones into my phone and the sound from my phone can then go up to my ears. Kind of like I plug a fiber or a cord into these really cool computer pieces of hardware and software.
Okay.
That can then shine a specific wavelength of light into the mouse's head, just like I'm plugging it into my phone and it's putting sound into my ears.
So there's actually a physical fiber that is attached to the mouse?
Yep.
Oh, okay.
You nailed it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. And so, but you're saying the mice are like, oh, you know, other than this fiber that keeps following me around, I'm good to go. So
you've actually nailed the whole entire mouse experience. It literally is. Other than this fiber attached to my head, I'm good.
Okay.
That is basically what's happening.
Okay. So then when you, in your experiments, you're saying you're shining a light. What made you choose the specific region of the brain that you did? And what is it that you think you might see in change-wise?
Absolutely. So for a little bit of context, I'm really interested in what are called neurotransmitters.
Mm-hmm.
So when you think of dopamine and serotonin,
mm-hmm.
right, you
mm-hmm.
might... Those are what we are known as neurotransmitters.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm interested in a neurotransmitter called histamine. So if you've ever taken maybe Benadryl
mm-hmm.
or you've taken an allergy medication,
yep.
that is an antihistamine. So we know that histamine is involved in allergies, inflammation, sometimes stress.
Mm-hmm.
But there's this really interesting body of scientific literature that has been reporting histamine to be involved in really cool things. Like cognition and memory and reward and all these other really cool behaviors, social behaviors, aggression,
mm-hmm.
sleep, all these really, really cool things. So what I'm interested in what these histamine cells are doing in the brain. If I activate or if I inhibit histamine cells, what happens to the behavior? And so that's how I've chosen which cells I'm going to optogenetically manipulate,
uh-huh.
that is the histamine cells. And then I've chosen a specific brain region because I'm interested in what's going on in that brain region between different neurotransmitter systems. So like the dopamine system and the histamine system,
mm-hmm.
I'm really interested in how they interact. So I've chosen a brain region that involves both of those systems.
Okay. All right. As an allergy sufferer, I am dying to hear all that you know about histamines. And then after that, I will have more questions for you. So I know that, you know, because they have antihistamines, you just assume histamines are bad. But clearly we need histamines. So spill the contents of your brain into mine.
Well, I'm going to disappoint you because I do not know much about histamine and allergies. I have chosen to look at histamine and rewarding behaviors. I'm very interested in how does histamine work in our brain to lead us to do things or maybe to not do things that are rewarding, right?
Sure,
like
sure.
For mice, it might be drinking sugary water or it might be snuggling with a friend. You know, these are things that mice do that are just naturally very rewarding behaviors.
And these are histamines have a role to play in that?
Well, we don't know. That's the thing. We don't know. So there's been, I've taken a little bit more of an entrepreneurial approach to my PhD. I really wanted to study something that had these really cool insights and mysteries,
mm-hmm.
but that not many people were studying. And
sure.
So when you ask me about all my knowledge about histamine, it really is basically just that it's involved in these really cool things, but we don't know how and we don't know when and we
okay.
don't know what context. But we do know that histamine has this grand therapeutic potential. So many people in the psychiatric world actually use those antihistamines I've been telling you about, so the drugs you normally take for allergies, people have started using them for anti-anxiety treatment. And so what is the relationship here between this molecule that can be involved in both allergies, which is a very external thing, and then something like anxiety, which is a very different process within the body? So I'm very interested sort of what's going on in histamine at the base level, at the reward level, and then eventually how can we extrapolate that to maybe a disease state, or thinking of histamine more as something that we can use to treat these psychiatric diseases.
Wow. I don't even know how to process that, because that's just amazing. So at what point did someone cotton to the fact that histamine had these properties? Was that fairly recently, or how far back does this knowledge go?
Yeah, so I've been looking at papers from the late 1900s, as well as into the early 2000s and up until right now.
Okay.
There have been people studying histamine for decades, but it's gotten less attention. So normally, especially in the science space, when I say neurotransmitters, you normally will think of dopamine or serotonin.
Mm-hmm.
Additionally, if I say neurotransmitter, even beyond the science space, you might hear of dopamine and serotonin. Mm-hmm. Earlier in our call, you mentioned potentially having thoughts around social media.
Mm-hmm.
And so dopamine and serotonin are these big neurotransmitters that are even talked about in the public space now.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're very, very highly studied. And I work in a laboratory space that studies those neurotransmitters. But I wanted to bring an interesting spin on it.
Mm-hmm.
And so my thought was that maybe I can take these decades of studies that have been on histamine but haven't gone into great detail or haven't really given histamine the time of day. Maybe I can do that in conjunction with some of the work around dopamine and serotonin as well, and see what we see. It's a mystery, but I'm just chasing the magic here.
Wow. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco. We are speaking with Ashley Moses, who is a PhD candidate in neuroscience at Stanford University. And let's get back to when you guys are using these molecular, I guess, DNA strands to sort of modify mouse behavior. You mentioned that people have modified mating habits, eating habits. Are there other things that have been modified, or is that still a work in progress?
Oh, there's a lot of things. You can change aggression. You can also change sleep. You can change motor behavior. So essentially any behavior that we test in mice, people are trying to perturb it with a technique like the one that I've explained, this optogenetic technique where you're using light to sort of control the brain in a way. And so essentially what a lot of us neuroscientists are trying to get at is what type of cell, what molecules, and what brain region or regions are responsible or involved in a certain behavior, and can we prove that? And optogenetics is a great way to prove that, because you can essentially manipulate the region or the molecule or the cell that you're interested in, and you can show, like, hey, me over here, hi, I changed sleep. The mouse doesn't sleep as long after I did this manipulation. And so that's why it's such a really, really powerful technique.
Now, you mentioned being able to change motor functions. So is that a part of research that maybe could be extrapolated, like once it gets into like therapeutic research for people with like Parkinson's and other types of motor dysfunctions?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You totally nailed it. So that is a perfect example of how optogenetics can be used to sort of change this brain activity and then eventually be used to maybe even alleviate symptoms of disorders like Parkinson's disease. And that is a yeah, that is a perfect example of how optogenetics would be used to go from this basic research, can I change this behavior, into something a bit more therapeutic or translational in humans.
Okay. And then there's the flip side of that, which is like, can it be used to like for nefarious purposes, to stimulate aggression and whatnot in people to make, you know, to make like the perfect soldier
to reduce
that the empathy molecule or.
Yeah, absolutely. There are, I don't know, actually, if optogenetics is being used in humans. I don't believe the technology is. And so right now, in the basic sense, like the basic science sense, mm-hmm. it's primarily used to just understand the circuit.
Sure.
And the brain parts that are involved. And so you might say, can it be used for nefarious purposes to increase aggression? And I guess from a basic science sense, it's more like, can we use this technique to understand what parts of the brain are even involved in aggression in the first place and potentially target those to decrease aggression in patients or in people? So, yes, I think there are tons of really, really interesting ethical questions to be asked about science in general and especially neuroscience and where we're headed. And that's potentially a really good one.
And when you're doing this research, or actually, I'll just do it in general, what or how often do you, as scientists, engage in these discussions about the ethical considerations of the various branches of research that is getting done?
In my mind, I think it depends on the person. There are some people in spaces, there are tons of people in spaces having these conversations. And so if you are interested in those sorts of conversations, you can find your people, which is great. Also, as students, we are required to take courses that have us talk about these sorts of issues, especially when it comes to making claims, analyzing your data, presenting your data in an appropriate way. So not only can you go and find people who have those conversations for fun, you are also exposed to those conversations in a sort of rigorous programmatic way to ensure that we are doing the best that we possibly can. And to be honest, those are some of my favorite conversations that we have, because I think we always need to be thinking about what we're doing and why we're doing it and having it centered in goodness rather than other sort of, in your words, nefarious ways.
Okay.
But I do think we can, as a whole, as a society, have more interdisciplinary conversations, right? So have those in ethics and those in law and those in policy and health talk even more to those in science and physics and chemistry and all those sorts of things. So there's always room for improvement, but I think so far I've really enjoyed the conversations that I've had.
Excellent. Now I want to go some more into like the nuts and bolts of what you do. So on a typical day in the lab, what does that look like from the moment you step through the door till, you know, the day to the minute you walk out the door? What is your workflow? What are you doing?
It depends. So it definitely depends on the day. I feel like that's a very sciencey answer. It depends. But I could give you an example of a day.
Yes.
So it always starts with a good morning with my colleagues.
And the mice.
I chose a laboratory basically based on people who would tell me good morning or not. I know that sounds very silly, but it's a really wonderful thing to have folks around you that just say good morning and are excited to see you. So then I find my desk, and there's a range of things that can happen for the day. It could be a lab meeting day where we discuss papers and data, and we give each other feedback, and we kind of circle in community to talk about science that's going on in our lab or in the field. It could be a heavy behavior day, right? Maybe I have made all these mice, I've done the brain surgery, and they're ready to go, and so I do an optogenetic experiment, as I've been discussing. Or it might be a surgery day, and that might be a day where I've got my forceps or tweezers, as it's more known colloquially, and I've got my special setup, and I'm doing surgery on a mouse brain under a microscope. So that might be hours of surgery that day. And so it really ranges from these more meetings and community to running this mouse behavior and analyzing the data, mm-hmm. all the way to prepping for those sorts of experiments by doing surgery.
And how many mice do you, like, because you were talking about you have a day of discovery, you've got a row of mice ready to go. So mm-hmm. how many mice are we talking about? And how, like, are you running one test at a time? Like, I want to, like how do you run these tests?
Yeah, so in the space that I'm in, it's pretty characteristic for a group of mice to have about 10 mice in it.
Okay.
In order for you to basically find the finding or see the result, the field normally likes you to have 8 to 12 mice in a cohort.
Okay.
So to speak. And so it's really, really, really important when you're running these mouse behavior experiments that you control for everything. I mean, we are quiet. We don't wear perfume. We don't want the mouse to be stressed by the way that we're handling them. We don't need loud noises in the environment. We don't want the mouse to be, like I said, confused or stressed. So everything needs to be very clean. It's as rigorous as we can possibly make it. And so it's normally one mouse at a time in one box or whatever setup you currently have.
Uh-huh.
And then you're testing that one behavior for maybe 30 minutes. And then you take that mouse out and you might test it on another day or another week.
Mm-hmm.
It really depends on the experimenter and what they're looking for. But you want to make sure that the mouse is as calm and, I guess, happy as mm-hmm. you possibly can make it.
So to that end, like, you go into the lab, you open a box. How are the mice living? Like, you know, I kind of think of it like, oh, they have these like plush digs for a mouse. But and what does that look like? And then when you're picking them up, like, how do you handle them so that you know, like, what are the signs that you've got a super chill mouse?
Sure. So the mice live in their own little community.
Okay.
So they have a little cage with bedding and nests that they form. They get free food all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it's free to them, but you know, the laboratories pay for the food. They get water constantly, and they hang out with about five buddies.
Okay.
Four or five buddies in there. And so you'll have males and females. They'll be separated because we don't want to accidentally have some mice babies that we weren't ready for.
Sure.
So we pair them with their groups of buddies, and then we pick them up. Normally, you pick them up by the tail, and you can put them on your hand, or you can put them in your hand.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have a really chill mouse, that mouse will just sit in your hand like a little buddy.
Okay.
And sometimes, it depends on what organism you use, but I have seen folks who work with rats, and rats are about the size of a very small chihuahua, and sometimes those rats will just cuddle with their owner. So we are by owner, I mean the scientist.
Sure.
So we are trying to make sure that they are as healthy and happy as possible.
Okay. So when you reach in and you take a mouse, you say that some of the mice are, you know, they'll just be like, oh, okay, this isn't bad. But when you get a mouse that is a bit agitated, mm-hmm. do you just put them back and go, oh, not today, you know, today's not the day for this one?
Well, over time, they get more used to you.
Sure.
So they do definitely start off as a, not today, lady. Please do not come in here with your big hands
mm-hmm.
and start interrupting my space. But then eventually they do warm up to getting used to you. And you, as an experimenter, you normally have to go through that process with the mouse and really habituate them to you and to their environment. So we give them ample time in a brand new environment to just soak it all in,
mm-hmm.
Just as we would do with humans. You know, you go to a new space and you need to smell the smells and see the sights. The same is for the mouse. Now, if the mouse is particularly aggressive that day, you might get bitten. And normally that's fine, both for you and the mouse. You move forward. But if that is the case, then sometimes we even have gardening gloves in the laboratory. So that when you reach in for the mouse, they, instead of biting you, they bite the gardening glove. So gardening gloves are actually a little bit of a hack for behavioral neuroscientists here.
Okay. And so now you've got your 10 mice. They all have the neural implants. And then So I know you probably have a control mouse where you're not shining any light. And then with the other mice, is it the intensity of the light, the duration of the light? How do you set that up?
Sure. It's all of the above. So we consider things like intensity. We consider things like the wavelength of the light as well. Depends on whatever sort of molecular substance you have ingested into the mouse's brain. And then also duration as well.
So
how many seconds is the light on? How many seconds is the light off? Because ultimately you are shining a very bright light into the mouse's brain. And so you want to make sure that you are not damaging any tissue, you know? So
if you sit
under the sun for a very long time, that hurts, and eventually your skin will become damaged.
Mm-hmm.
We definitely want to make sure we're not overheating the mouse's brain, so it's really important to make sure you have an off period and an on period of the light to keep everything all healthy and happy.
It's almost like the celery experiment, only with mice, because you have like these different containers and you're maybe shining different colored lights at them, you know, over a period of time. So,
you know, I have actually never thought of it like that. And you have just brought so much joy to my life. So thank you for connecting those dots. It's actually a really beautiful, beautiful thing for me. I appreciate it.
What is something that you have learned in neuroscience that blew your mind, that you were just like, I can't believe this. I'm amazed by this.
I already accidentally might have answered this question, but for me, it was when I could clear those brains and image them under a microscope. And that was just a couple years ago. My mind was absolutely blown. I was like, I am looking at a piece of glass that used to be a brain, is essentially how it felt. And I would tell everybody who would listen to me I do magic at work. And so for me, that is just so cool. And I think the technological advancements that are happening in the field, particularly that one for me in my life, but many others for other folks, it blew my mind. When I think about it, I have a smile on my face, because I just think that is such a cool moment in science, is when you're blown away by the work that you can do, not necessarily by the results.
Right.
Because we never know what's going to happen.
Sure.
And most of the time they're negative. You know, they don't show you what you want to see,
mm-hmm.
or they don't show you what you think you'll see.
Mm-hmm.
But when you can do a technique that you're proud of and you think it's really cool and you just get blown away by the process, I think it's like that very cliche saying of, you know, enjoying the journey, not the
mm-hmm.
destination.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was a moment in my life and in my science career where I really enjoyed the journey because it was magical.
I gotta say, if it were me and a brain just suddenly turned to glass, I'd be like, I gotta take a million pictures of this so that I can remember it forever.
I definitely did. And also I took videos as well. So the process where it goes from a brain looking brain to a glass looking brain is kind of in the span of seconds, and so you can actually record it all on video and send it.
But so you said like it took like a month, right?
Yes, it takes a month to get the brain ready for it to come to your mind.
Oh, so it's like, you know, nothing, glass.
Exactly. It's kind of like training for a race, like a running race.
Oh, okay.
And then you have your race day. So the brain was just training, and then boom, it ran the race, and all of our minds were blown. So it's pretty cool. It was pretty fun.
And what was it a primate brain or a mouse brain, or what kind of brain was it, or is it?
It's always been mice for me. And you can actually, there are some people who actually do, you could, like an entire mouse sort of body or skeleton in a way, like a small cleared organism.
Mm-hmm.
But I have only ever done it in a brain. That's it. But I believe you can use it for many other instances.
Okay. Again, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco. We're speaking with Ashley Moses, who's a PhD candidate in neuroscience. And outside of the lab, you run a communication nonprofit called The Civilian. What's that?
Right when I entered into graduate school, I was blown away by how hard it is to read scientific papers.
Oh, yeah.
I was taking a class in a field that is not my own. It's adjacent, though, and I was tasked with reading a paper. I tried to read it, and it took me hours upon hours to really digest what was going on. And I am in science, mm-hmm. right? I am a neuroscientist, and mm-hmm. I still could not understand this subfield of neuroscience. And so mm-hmm. I just got a little sad. I was like, well, what if I handed this paper to my mom or my brother or my grandma? Would they be unable to understand it, or would they just say, why did you give this to me? Thank you for the coaster. You know, like, what am I supposed to do with this? So I just started embarking on this journey of trying to find ways to teach scientists to share their work in a more digestible way. Mm-hmm. So the civilian, we work with scientists to take those really daunting, messy, really highly complicated papers and turn them into a summary of that paper that a high schooler could understand. Mm-hmm. So our average reading level of the articles that we produce are under an 11th grade reading level, so okay. under a junior in high school. And wow. the whole goal is to just share that scientific knowledge with as many people as possible and in a way that they can understand.
Now, do you ever get any pushback on that? Like, no, we don't want to dumb down our work.
I have, definitely. That's why we take a very educational approach rather mm-hmm. than coming in and saying, you need to do this, you need to do that, you need mm-hmm. to do this, this is bad, mm-hmm. this is bad, mm-hmm. this is bad. Mm-hmm. It's more like, hey, this is what we recommend. You don't need to provide all of this detail, and this is how we suggest you change it, and this is why. And so oftentimes we are also met with many scientists who are just very grateful and very excited for the opportunity to create their or to turn their work into something that is much more digestible. And so maybe there have been a few scientists who have said, this is not my cup of tea, but mm-hmm. there have been plenty who have just been like, wow, this is amazing. Thank you for turning my research or helping me turn my research into this new way of looking at it.
Now, as someone who has, you know, you'll do a Google search on some scientific thing, and I don't know what they call it, a brief. I forget what they call it, but I'll see something, and it's clearly, you know, scientific paper. Like, this is a credible paper, but I'll start reading it, and after, you know, about two sentences in, I'm like, you know, like if you were to see inside my brain, you would just see like a little dot moving across from left to right. So what are some of the what's some of the advice that you give to scientists? Like, here's what you're doing. Here's how this would work better.
Absolutely. I have several pieces of advice, but I will start with two. The mm-hmm. first one is to ground all of your work in relevance. I think oftentimes us scientists might just think, this is really cool, this is really complicated, this has never been known before, this is why you should care. And in reality, a lot of people need it grounded in something a bit more, right? Mm-hmm. How does this impact my day-to-day?
Right.
How does this impact somebody I love? Or how does this impact my future? Mm-hmm. Right? So tell me why I should care. Why, and why? That is probably the biggest thing scientists forget to do. Even mm-hmm. in our laboratory presentations, like, tell me why this is the coolest thing I should care about. Because time is one of the most generous things anybody can give you. And so if somebody's giving you their time, whether it's reading your article, listening to you talk, whatever it may be, honor that time and tell them why it is the best way they could be spending their time. And that is with why and with relevance. And the second thing is to accept the fact that you cannot and should not talk about every single thing you did, because at the end of the day, a lot of folks just get lost. So these mm-hmm. scientific papers that we publish are years and years and years of experiments. Mm-hmm. And in reality, you don't need to tell somebody all of that. And I find that that's very difficult for scientists because they want to share all the details of all of their work. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, the most important details need to be distilled, and they all need to be couched in relevance as to why somebody should care.
So when the scientists are, you know, basically just sharing everything, is that because of it's a tradition of showing all of your work, or is that just because it's how they've always done it?
I think it might be a little bit of both.
Okay.
So we don't, as scientists, we don't have as much scientific communication training as I think would be useful, both in our science space, right? Scientists talking to scientists, and also outside of it, right? Scientists talking to non-scientists. So I think both of those avenues could use for a bit more training. I think for many folks, it is traditional in both of those spaces, right? Scientists to scientists and scientists to non-scientists. I think in both of those spaces, it is traditional to share a lot and very heavily. And actually, one of the biggest skills that I've learned so far in my PhD is strategic communication, right? It's a better way of saying sales. You know, it's just like we need to be able to present in a way that is most effective for our audience. We need to think about our audience when we're speaking and when we're writing. And I just think that we haven't been trained as much on that. And that's sort of the gap that the civilian is trying to fill, is by helping to train scientists to become better communicators just by starting with a summary of their recent publication.
Now, is there a scientific brief or publication that just right out of the gate got it right, like it was delivered in a way that civilians and other scientists could understand it?
It is definitely a spectrum of the publication ease of understanding or accessibility. And there are some papers I find to be really lovely and really well written. And there are some platforms that are including summaries now with their publications, or including just like an abstract, so just like a small summary paragraph instead of a whole written paper with their publications. I think that is a great next step. I think every journal should do that. And so there are definitely, there's a spectrum as far as where the publication is published. Then there's also a spectrum about within the publications themselves about whether or not they're more easily understood or not. So, and I think it depends on who's, you know, where you're coming from and what walk of life you are from. I actually think everybody's a scientist. That I don't know if that's an unpopular opinion, but if you cook at home, you are a scientist. If you run, you are a scientist. If you play a sport, if you sing, there's science all around us. And I think it just really depends about what scientists we're talking to when we write our work. And oftentimes it's too complicated for scientists that don't do science in the lab every day. So again, just a long way of saying it's a spectrum.
Well, they say babies are the ultimate behavioral scientists because they're constantly doing things to see.
Absolutely.
Like, how many times can I throw this on the floor before they take it away? Or, you know, what happens when I do, you know, they're constantly just trying to figure out the world in a sort of a baby scientific method. So
absolutely. And I actually just got a puppy, and they are also little behavioral scientists as well. So it's very interesting to think about that way.
Like they're trying to train their human to give them treats.
Definitely, we are being trained.
So what is a, what would you say would be a little known neuroscience factoid that you think would fascinate the average person? I mean, I was fascinated by the celery, so I'm really easy to please. But what would you say would be just something that you're like, hey, did you know this?
Ooh.
I'm sure there's a lot of things.
I appreciate this question because I think oftentimes we take for granted the bits of information that we know as just commonplace. And so I do appreciate you asking me this. I think something that I find really interesting, and I like to tell people who are not in neuroscience, is that we have, and again, most of this conversation has been technically based, and so it kind of shows you what I find most interesting. But we have these capabilities with microscopes and with really cool genetic techniques to just light up the brain. And I think it looks like a constellation of stars. And so what I would tell somebody who might not know much about neuroscience would be, we have these really cool techniques where when you see somebody you love, or you eat sugary food, or you get angry, or you wake up, we have these techniques where we can show you where in your brain that happened.
Really?
Based on a constellation of cells that exists within your skull. And we can do this particularly in mice. I'm not going to go into anybody's brain and do them. But
okay.
On my own space, we can use the way that the brain cells act and all these really cool techniques to light up the brain and tell you exactly what's going on in what region. And I just think that that is really, really cool.
And
so, that's what I would probably say is a fun little factoid, is that we can light up the brain in really cool ways and visualize it as well.
So when you're looking at the brain, when let's say someone just ate a sugary snack and you're like, okay, it's here. Is it in the same place in everybody's brain, or like, because, you know, you look at a map of the world and it's like California is always, you know, California. But is it the same from brain to brain within a species?
For many behaviors, it is. So there are certain brain regions that we know are involved in, like motor behavior or mating behavior, feeding behavior,
mm-hmm.
right? And so there are many instances where those brain regions themselves are very similar. But how they're connected and the maybe the intensity by which they respond, that mm-hmm. can be different depending on each person. So I'm not sure if folks are familiar with Alex Honnold. He is the person who climbed El Capitan in Yosemite, I believe it was, without any ropes.
Wow.
So he just climbed the side of the mountain, and they did some brain visualization on him and found that there are certain brain regions that are, I believe, activated less because he had less fear, sort of, what the gist was. And so that would be an example of how maybe the brain region is the same for many people, but how it responds might be different depending on the person.
Okay. And did they also do things to see if other regions lit up that help him recognize, like, where to get handholds and footholds of things? Because that would be fascinating to be like, oh, well, he's got a heightened sense of, and was he colorblind? Or, like, what else did they look at in this person's brain?
Yeah, I don't know exactly all the things that they checked for. I only remember this sort of like fear-based brain region, but uh-huh. I'm sure they've done so many tests on him because he has done some really incredible things.
Okay. Well, we are almost out of time, and I'm just fascinated. I mean, you had me at celery changing colors, to be honest. And then when you turned a brain into glass, I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. So can you tell us one other magical thing that you've done where you're just like, this is so cool, and I'm just so glad that I'm a scientist that I can do this?
Oh, wow.
Obviously, there are a lot.
Yeah, there are quite a few things. I think for me personally, and this might be more, I know that I've mentioned so many techniques, so mm-hmm. I'm trying to get out of the techniques.
Oh, I don't mind.
For me, something that's really cool is when I give a important lab meeting
uh-huh.
and somebody who's a younger student asks a question. That makes me proud as a scientist. So I think one of the best sort of examples that you are giving a conversation or you are giving a presentation that somebody can understand
uh-huh.
is when somebody younger than you or somebody who's brand new to the space asks a question and is involved in your conversation. And so for me, that makes me excited as a scientist, is when we are having a conversation and those folks speak up and feel like they can be a part of the discussion, because ultimately they're the future, right? They're the future
yes,
of science.
Yes.
So there are so many different aspects of being a scientist. It's not just running experiments and collecting data and, you know, thinking about things. It's also how you're talking about it and the community you work with. And so I think building the community of scientists that I have around me now is something I'm really excited about, because they're really wonderful people to work with, and that makes doing science a lot more fun.
And if you had to explain what you did to, say, a 10-year-old, or have you even had to, like, how would you explain what you do in a way that an elementary school kid can go? I mean, if you tell an elementary school kid you turn the brain to glass, that's super cool. But if you had to explain, like, what you're doing to an elementary school kid, how would you explain it?
I would probably say that the cells in the brain talk to each other through these really cool molecules. And I am trying to figure out how the cells talk to each other, when and why they talk to each other.
Okay. All right. Well, with that, Ashley Moses, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today. You have touched my mind. I'm going to go online and see if I can find videos of brains turning to glass, because that just sounds amazing. And I'll probably look up the celery one, because, you know, I didn't have very good science growing up. So that just sounds fascinating to me. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Amazing. Thank you so much for having me. I hope you enjoy both the glass brain and the colorful celery.
Thank you. All right, people of Earth, that was amazing. Glass brains and molecules and celery changing colors and all of that. If your mind isn't touched, it's because you're making a conscious decision not to be touched, and we would need to look at those cells to see why that is. Mr. Ford's going to be coming up in just a little bit. I'm going to leave you with the dandy sounds. It's called Below My Cranium. Until next week, my friends, ta-ta, and toodly-doo. Parietal, frontal,